Welcome to Bicom's weekly podcast. My name is James Serene. What we are discussing this week is trying to understand what is going on in terms of this campaign between the wars, so it's called, in Israeli military circles, where Israel is targeting Iranian forces and Iranian proxy militias in Syria and Iraq, and also fighting Hezbollah in Lebanon. And I'm delighted to be joined, first off, by Brigadier General Michael Herzog, who's a fellow for BICOM, also at the Washington Institute. Welcome to the podcast, Mike.
Hello, happy to be on the podcast.
So if I could start off by just asking where you think we are in terms of this campaign, because there was a lot of news at the end of the summer where Israel seemed to be potentially hitting targets in Iraq, in Syria, which had been going on itself for a couple of years, and then also this groundbreaking incident where Israel seemed to be using a drone to take out elements of Hezbollah's precision missile project in Beirut itself. But that seems to have quietened down a little, but we are still hearing reports of unattributed strikes in Iraq. So I wonder if you could tell us, sort of, here we are in early October, a month or so later, where you think we are now?
Well, the showdown between Israel and Iran apparently expanded from Syria to Iraq and Lebanon. The focus in recent years was Syria, where Iran has been trying to build a military front facing Israel with tens of thousands of proxy forces, with its own forces, with drones, with thousands of rockets, and also try to introduce a project to convert part of Hezbollah's arsenal of dumb rockets into accurate ones. But given Israel's pressure on Iran in Syria, which intensified with time, Iran switched some of its designs to Lebanon and Iraq. So let's start with Lebanon. Iran moved the critical elements of its so-called precision project, the project to convert some of Hezbollah's dumb rockets into accurate ones, to hidden sites in Lebanon. Israel exposed them publicly, and they were moved to other areas. But what really happened, the important development, is that the conversion effort did not bear fruit in terms of producing highly accurate rockets on industrial scale. Apparently, the Iranians and Hezbollah faced some technical and other difficulties. So they decided to switch gear and design facilities to manufacture rockets from scratch. So we're not only talking about converting rockets, which, as I said, did not bear sufficient fruit, but manufacturing rockets on an industrial scale. Israel recently exposed that Iran has built for Hezbollah such a facility in the Bekaa Valley in eastern Lebanon. And apparently, the recent incident where drones attacked something in Beirut was connected to it, even though Israel never assumed the official responsibility. But according to media reports, what was targeted was an 8-ton mixer, which is designed to mix fuels in order to serve as a solid propellant in rockets and missiles. And there was a window of opportunity before this mixer went underground. It was targeted by drones. This was a deviation from the script of recent years, where Israel concentrated on Syria. It was the first time, essentially since 2006, the Second Lebanon War, that such an operation was carried out. And coincidentally, it was at the same time that Israel thwarted an attempted strike by Iran from Syria into the Golan Heights and apparently killed some Hezbollah operatives. And this pushed Hezbollah to respond militarily, but in a very, very constrained way. only against military targets, only along the border, not deep in Israel. And I think they were very quick to contain this incident and move on. But
this was just for our listeners to refresh people's memories. This was the incident where they attacked a military vehicle near an IDF base, and then it was in the news a lot because there was a kind of fake medical evacuation which appeared to show wounded Israeli soldiers, and that was then revealed afterwards to be part of a kind of psyops, like to convince Hezbollah that their job was done, and that's what people will remember. That was a very high profile incident.
That's correct, but I think that incident also shows how close one could get to escalation. Yeah. Without desiring it, because in that case, when Hezbollah fired, they also targeted a medical ambulance and with five soldiers inside, and they missed it. But they hit the ambulance, and the soldier would have been killed. I think we'd probably be in a different place today. So in such cases, there's always potential for escalation. As I said, Israel is more focused on Syria and less on Lebanon because the risk of escalation are higher. But this latest incident, assuming Israel was behind it, and as I said, Israel did not assume responsibility, tells you that there's also potential in Lebanon as long as Iran and Hezbollah keep pushing to establish facilities for manufacturing accurate rockets, something that from Israeli point of view is a very, very serious development, and Israel is determined to take action in order to thwart that. Mm-hmm. But part of the rocket project was moved also to Iraq, and there is evidence that Iran provided its Shiite proxies in Iraq, part of the PMU, Popular Mobilization Units, with accurate rockets, highly accurate rockets, with a range to Israel. We're not talking about big numbers, probably dozens, but with time, this operation expanded. And Iran also apparently moved to establish logistical facilities on both sides of the Iraq-Syria border. By the way, that border was opened earlier this week on September 30th. The crossing, so-called Abu Kamal on the Syrian side and Al-Qaim on the Iraqi side, that border crossing was opened officially on September 30th. And from an Israeli and Western point of view, this is part of Iran's design to create a so-called contiguous corridor stretching from Iran through Iraq and Syria to the Mediterranean. But we've seen Iran also established a logistical compound, huge compound, the Imam Ali compound, very close to the Syria-Iraq border. And according to Israeli intelligence, the intention behind these moves is, first of all, to create an arsenal of accurate rockets on the Iraqi side of the border, which could be used against Israel in times of tension, war, or need. And secondly, to create what one might call the kind of a way station from where they can send rockets and also proxy troops to Syria and Lebanon in time of need. And there's also talk of potentially manufacturing rockets on that side of the border. And we've seen recently a series of strikes in that area on both sides of the border. Again, Israel never assumed responsibility, but it is widely assumed that Israel is behind at least some of these strikes. And according to media reports, there were at least 8 incidents where that border area was attacked on both sides of the border. So assuming Israel did have a hand in some of these incidents, the bottom line is the showdown between Israel and Iran has expanded. It's not only in Syria. but it also includes Lebanon and Iraq, which means that the potential for escalation is also higher.
Can I ask a question about capability here in terms of Israel? I mean, I think sometimes people hear these stories and they almost take it for granted that, you know, that maybe Israel is behind it and they're carrying out these strikes. But I mean, it doesn't really get even into an examination of how on earth this is possible in terms of, you know, how does Israel know what is going on here? I mean, it must be like an immense effort that is sort of, you know, signals intelligence, human intelligence, surveillance. I mean, could you give us a glimpse of just how huge that effort must be in order to be able to sort of know the level of detail of what Iran and its proxies are doing?
Yeah, ultimately, it's about fusion of various sources of information, signal intelligence, human intelligence, visual intelligence, and other types of intelligence. It's about focusing your intelligence attention at certain areas where you suspect or know that there is dangerous activity. And someone who spent quite a few years as an intelligence officer, I can tell you that the main element here is the fusion of various sources to create a picture and a continuous attention to a certain area so you can detect changes on the ground and new developments. Of course, naturally, the closer it is to our borders, the more information we have. But still, yeah. I assume that when we talk about the Syria-Iraq border or even parts of Iraq, Israel could still muster sufficient information to carry out military strikes, even though I don't believe that everything that happened in Iraq is Israel's operation. I think there's a natural tendency to attribute everything that happens there to Israel, but not everything is Israel.
Yeah, sure. And I mean, in terms of what Iran is doing, there's clear evidence, isn't there, that sort of Iran is constantly adapting and learning and trying to change its strategy in response to what Israel is doing. So it's not like, you know, they're just trying the same thing. It's a dynamic process. So you mentioned that, you know, first of all, they try and smuggle missiles in. That doesn't work. So then they try and build precision missiles from dumb missiles. Then they try and actually just set up a production line. How are things changing in other capability? I mean, it seems maybe superficially that they're sort of trying to build up bases, get supplies in, then they try somewhere else. But is it more sophisticated than that?
They are certainly drawing lessons and seeking new ways of responding to Israel or harming Israel. In Syria, I've seen like 4 or 5 cases of Iranian attempts at targeting Israel. Mostly it was about firing rockets, which were intercepted or did not cross the border. There was no major success in these attempts in the last nearly 2 years now. The recent incident was trying to send armed drones to Israel from the eastern part of Syria, not far away from the Golan Heights, and that was foiled by Israel. But I assume they draw lessons from each and every incident and looking for new ways. According to Israeli intelligence, one of the things that they would like to do is introduce new and more dangerous weapons into the Syrian theater, including defense capabilities and other capabilities, which could afford them more options to target Israel or respond to Israeli activities. So we have to assume that they haven't said the final word and they will look for new ways to strike Israel.
And just to be clear, which part of the, it's basically the Quds force of the IRGC that is really spearheading and responsible for most of this activity, isn't it?
Yeah, well, people talk about the IRGC, but essentially this is a Quds force because the Quds force is responsible for all operational activities outside the borders of Iran. The IRGC has many more tasks and responsibilities in Iran itself and as part of the defense establishment. But the Lebanon file, the Syria file, the Iraq file, the Yemen file, all these files are managed by the Quds force headed by Qasem Soleimani. So if you really want to apply pressure to kind of block Iran's ambition in the region, you have to focus on the Quds force.
If I could just change tack slightly and just talk a little bit about the actual public acknowledgement by Israeli politicians and others about these kinds of attacks. And there's been a lot of discussion over the last few weeks about how the rhetoric has changed and how the acknowledgement of responsibility has changed. And people following this closely will remember that there have only been a few occasions before the summer where Israel directly talked about what had happened, what they'd done in response, and Iran's involvement. And those were when there was a, I believe when there was a most recently when there was an Iranian drone sent into Israel, Israeli airspace in February 18. Then there was the incident in May 18 when Iran fired Grad missiles into Israel and Israel responded. And then we had the incident with the Mount Hermon and the missile fired on there. And then we had some of the incidents over the summer. But it does, and in those incidents, Israel always was quite specific about saying, this is what we've done and Iran is behind it. But otherwise, they don't really comment on individual strikes. And there's been some commentators saying that, you know, the rhetoric has become much more specific. And that was perhaps fueled by the fact that Israel was in an election campaign. We saw some very specific comments by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, which seemed to be a change in approach. And most significantly, we had a first major interview with the former IDF Chief of Staff, Gadi Eisenkot, did a big interview last week where he specifically said he thought what he described as this loss of ambiguity about who is responsible was affecting Israeli security and affecting deterrence. And I just wondered what your thoughts on that were, given that I suppose Israel is bracing itself maybe for an Iranian response now. How do you think the public acknowledgement and the public kind of chatter about all this activity is affecting the kind of balance of deterrence and what Israel's adversaries might do?
Israel has been pushing back against the Iranian plans and activities in Syria for a few years now. Israel carried out hundreds, if not more than that, strikes against Iranian and Iranian proxy targets in Syria and elsewhere. And the policy was always to not assume responsibility for any specific action. Israel did acknowledge that it is pushing back, taking action against Iranians and their proxies, but very rarely, only when there's no other alternative, assumed responsibility for a specific action. That was Israeli leaders began to deviate this script last year, and on more than one occasion, either hinted or even acknowledged explicitly certain Israeli activities. And I must say, I agree with General Eisenkot's criticism that this is unhelpful because the whole idea behind not assuming responsibility was to allow the other side what we used to call a zone of deniability. So that if you acknowledge officially that you took action, you put pressure on them to respond. They have to show to their own public that they are responding. And we much preferred for a long time to provide them with this zone of deniability and continue doing what we were doing. Some people attribute those utterances to domestic politics in Israel. Maybe, maybe not. All I can say is that I agree with General Eisenkot, and I do hope that this criticism will get to public figures in Israel and convince them to go back to the former policy.
Michael Herzog, thank you so much for joining us. That's been a really good comprehensive overview of what are sometimes very complex and difficult issues for our listeners to understand. So thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Hi there, this is Roni from BICOM, and I'm delighted to be joined by Philip Smythe, the Sora Fellow at the Washington Institute. So thank you for joining us for the newest edition of the BICOM podcast.
Thank you for having me on. I'm honored.
Wonderful. And just to get this started, I was wondering if you could give us an overview on a basic level of where the Shia militias, the Iranian Shia militias are in the region, where they're coming from, how many there are.
Sure. If we're looking at Iranian-controlled or at least Iranian-backed Shia militias, they are everywhere from Gaza, where there's at least one. And it's interesting because there aren't many Shia in Gaza, but hey, they find a way. Lebanon, you have Lebanese Hezbollah. In Syria, you have domestic groups that are there. So essentially, they've been modeled off of Lebanese Hezbollah. Sometimes they're under the command of Lebanese Hezbollah, but they are Shia in composition. The Shia only make up maybe 1% of the Syrian population, but they're still there. You then have other Hezbollah-style groups that are controlled by the Iranians, but they're not a Shia militia. It's not Shia. But then you also have Iraqi groups. In Iraq itself, you have the Hashd al-Shaabi, or the Popular Mobilization Forces, or PMFs as they're sometimes called. And within that structure, you have nearly 100 groups. When I say nearly 100 groups, I'm also talking about sub-networks and different groups that are maybe more loosely affiliated. So the Iranians have a lot of people to cull from and a lot of people to use. And I think if we look at the issue of a Shia militia, I was bringing up other kind of multi-sectarian or other different sectarian or different ethnic groups that they have. Everything follows a general model, kind of like Lebanese Hezbollah. And they're trying to kind of Hezbollahize everybody into these different collectives. But the Shia militias really make up the tip of their spear because they are religiously similar to them. So that means they are more... I guess, can adhere to their ideological precepts a bit better. And there's also that kind of connection there along the minority scope of viewing the realm, viewing the Middle East. And also they've had the most experience with them in terms of fighting, commanding them, and just generally working with them.
Can you speak to specifically what the relations are between these various groups in Iran? Are they just proxies? Do they have their own agency, freedom of decision making, or is it really controlled from Tehran?
Well, it always depends on the group. But beyond that, I think we need to focus on a few different other issues. So when we look at a proxy relationship, we think about it in the Western sense. And the Americans, if you use the American example, we don't really run proxies all that well. We kind of have loose connections with them. We don't really command them. We don't have an ideological system that really goes for it. You know, during the Cold War, hey, if you fought commies, then, you know, I guess that was sometimes a good thing, and we'd kind of back you and give you support when needed and then just not really be there. The Iranians run it in a way, and I brought up Lebanese Hezbollah before, where there is an ideological component. The ideological component in Arabic, it's called Absolute Wilayat al-Faqih. So they believe that Iran's supreme leader, Ali Khamenei, is kind of the boss of bosses. He is the agent that Imam al-Mahdi uses on earth in order to execute his will. And so that's really where their loyalties lay. And you see a lot of the higher ups in a lot of these organizations are believers, or they've been kind of co-opted into the system. A lot of the Shia militias that the Iranians control will say, we are believers in, you know, quote unquote, the Wilayat al-Faqih. It's a big thing for them to say that they are part of it. So there's a connection there. There's also the monetary connections, where they're roped into a whole other system. You know, we look at everything in terms of how states operate, and it's a very, very Western mindset. With them, it's not only are some of these groups, or you know, one group like Lebanese Hezbollah. Lebanese Hezbollah has members in parliament, and they also have their own militia and their own state within a state. But then there's another layer to this that's ideologically speaking, they're roped in with these other groups. They're roped in with how Khamenei sees the world through his religious concepts. And through his own, I guess, understanding of how the world is working. And they're tied in with the Revolutionary Guard Corps and, you know, all these other different little organizations. So there's a lot of different levels to it. It's kind of like peeling back the onion and how many layers are there. But in general, the amount of control that the Iranians exhibit, I mean, if you listen to someone like Naim Qasem, the number two in Lebanese Hezbollah, said, if there is issues of war, yes, the Iranians are the ones who give the orders. And I think we've seen that with Syria. You had tons of Iraqis that were going there, some of them unwitting. You know, they were not, you know, adherents to Absolute Wilayat al-Faqih because the ideology isn't that popular for Shia. It's really not. what's kind of set in stone there eventually trickles down. So they'll use monetary incentives sometimes to control people. They'll use other political incentives. Sometimes it's a combination of all of the above. Other times they'll threaten people. But in general, control over many of these groups is quite tight. They give them enough leeway to do their own thing. And in fact, there have been disagreements within some of the organizations they control. One of the most loyal, which was Kitab Hezbollah in Iraq, that was formed out of the Butter Organization. Butter Organization goes all the way back to like the days when Lebanese Hezbollah was started in the early 80s, late 1970s even. The same people were kind of affiliated. But what ended up happening was in 2013, 2012, there's a dispute, a leadership dispute within Kitab Hezbollah. And a few of the leaders said, hey, we put all of our groups together to form Kitab Hezbollah, but we don't really want to deal with them anymore. We want to run our own show. So they formed a group called Kitab Sayyid al-Shuhada. There's going to be a lot of Kitabs and a lot of other groups with similar sounding names. So they formed this group, but if you look at it, it may have been a splinter from Kitab Hezbollah, but they were no less loyal to the Iranians. They had leadership disputes amongst themselves. You know, it's kind of like Linda Richman and Coffee Talk, you know, talk amongst yourselves. Well, they allow them to talk amongst themselves and hash those things out. Maybe they have disagreements, maybe they don't like each other. But at the end of the day, they have to still do Iran's bidding. So Kitab Sayyid al-Shuhada and Kitab Hezbollah fought alongside each other in Syria, fought alongside each other in Iraq, still have Iranian backing, still have the same ideological beliefs, except Kitab Hezbollah doesn't have somebody in parliament, whereas Kitab Sayyid al-Shuhada does. Same thing kind of goes with Butter Organization, and I'm working on something longer on the Butter Organization. If you look at them, they have sections that are more focused on armed movement. And then you have other sections that are more politically motivated. Yes, they have a huge militia, but it's interesting. Western policymakers will come out and say they're a little bit more moderate without, I guess, assessing the fact that maybe that's by design to look that way so they can grab onto a larger piece of the pie, let's say within the Iraqi parliamentary circles. Maybe because they were tasked with that by the Iranians. But in general, kind of the major groups that we look at, like Badr or Kitab Hezbollah or Saibah al-Haq or Lebanese Hezbollah, these guys have demonstrated time and time again that, yes, they may have internal frictions or other problems, but it doesn't mean they're any less loyal to the Iranians.
Great. And it's interesting. One of the things we didn't mention, because, you know, we were talking about proxies, but what is the Syrian army? So can you perhaps touch on what type of influence Iran has there? Within that army, if they're trying to expand their role within those armed forces, and sort of long term, what they might be trying to do there?
Quick answer for what the Iranians are doing to what's left of the Syrian Arab army is control as much of it as they can. Needless to say, there are tensions between the Russians and the Iranians. I mean, ignoring all of that, yes, they're still in a kind of strategic partnership. So they'll kind of fight it out for who controls what. But the Iranians had, they kind of executed a very good operation within Syria. Syrian Arab Army wouldn't have been able to function or do anything without Iranian support, without the tens of thousands of Shia jihadists that came from all these different militia groups that were recruited. But what the Iranians noticed was it's not just kind of, yes, we have proxy groups that you can send people there and then they're all ours and we're going to pull them out. No, they ingratiate themselves into society. And one way of doing that is through the Syrian Arab Army, but also other armed sections. So the Iranians were big pushers of the National Defense Forces, the NDF. The National Defense Forces were a collective of different militias, multi-sectarian. I mean, actually a lot of Sunni groups. There were some other Shia groups, and there were kind of local defense groups. They have all these different little umbrella names. And each time the Iranians will try to grab little chunks of it. They really do try to have their fingers in every single pie that's out on the windowsill. And the Syrian Arab Army is no different. So with Mahr al-Assad, who controls, I think, the 4th Division, they had a lot of influence with him. With some sections of the Republican Guard, they had some influence with it. With the NDF groups that I brought up before that are Syrians, they're from Syria, they're militias that are around there. They've had more success with some and then less success with others, depending on kind of what ideology they're following or, you know, what leaders wear, you know, who gets a free trip to Iran. So they haven't been, I mean, they haven't been lazy when it comes to infiltrating and controlling. But also, I mean, I don't want us to get lost in the kind of stream that the Iranians do it, and so that must mean they're pulling all the strings. Well, no, you had some Syrians who were more than happy to go along with them. Sometimes there's cash, sometimes there's other incentives. Other times, it's born out of necessity. You know, if I were Bashar al-Assad, if I didn't have those Shia militiamen who were saving me. And by the way, a lot of emphasis is placed in the West on how helpful the Russian Air Force was. And yes, air power is extraordinarily helpful. But without the Shia militiamen, without Iran's direct aid, Bashar al-Assad wouldn't be in power. Just it wouldn't have mattered. They were kind of the finger in the dike. So, their influence is generally all over the place. What's going on right now, though, between the Russians, and it's generally Russian-guided, and certain members of the Syrian army, and also with the Iranians, is there's a resorting out. Who controls what? Who has most influence with which units? And this is kind of natural consolidation. This happens after conflicts, and so I think that's kind of where we're going forward.
So then looking at these different, you know, between the proxies, Lebanese Hezbollah and the Syrian army and the various Iraqi Shia militias, and even looking at the Houthis, for example, can you speak to what type of capabilities these various organizations have, and particularly what type of threat that poses towards Israel and an American, you know, presence in those areas?
At the end of the day, every single Shia militia that the Iranians try to control is, by design, supposed to be threatening to the state of Israel and be involved at some point. You know, who knows when they want this grand battle, or maybe it won't even be a grand battle. It'll be, you know, a battle where they're poking at the Israelis all the time until they just bleed out. But every single one of these groups is designed to do that. Same thing goes to the United States. The United States, who they call, and I know this is always repeated, but I love saying it, we're the Shaitan al-Akbar, the great Satan, and, you know, Shaitan al-Zghir is the Israelis. But both of these functions, I mean, they have this function for both of these states. Now, in terms of armed capabilities, depends on the group sometimes, but the core organizations that the Iranians control have now developed some very strong capabilities since the Syrian war. One of them is now artillery usage. So when rocket attacks were happening, yes, Hezbollah would pop off a few Katyushas. Now they have more advanced intermediate range missiles. Now they have longer range missiles. Now they have cruise missiles that can hit ships. So that's on one side. On another side, you now have trained members who are, I guess, were involved in combined arms warfare, where they're getting air support from the Russians, had armored support from other, let's say, Iraqi Shia who were manning the tanks, and then also had infantry support from Lebanese Hezbollah members. And oh, P.S., they were also getting rocket artillery support, maybe from the Syrian Arab Army. That's a capability they could have only wished for in terms of learning how a proper military, I guess a more modernized military, works, as opposed to being some asymmetric force, you know, that only focuses on, let's say, IEDing a tank or something. They have those skills as well. They're very good at it. And also, by the way, they still use those skills. In Bahrain, I did a lot of early work on Bahrain, actually, with a flag for one of the Bahraini militant groups is on my wall. They won't be missing it. But the interesting thing about that is that technology, that know-how, was transferred from the Iraqi Shia groups that they were controlling to these Bahraini Shia groups, and then using almost the same kind of bomb designs to target local security forces and potentially target the Americans. Right now, going back to your question about, I guess, what threats that they all pose, I mean, the threats, I mean, I could fill up an entire book with the amounts of threats they could do. I mean, you have a political side to this. Many of these groups are not just military organs, they're just militias. They're more complex than that, where, you know, they have a political side to them. And I don't want to say a political wing. The group is they're usually these unitary organizations. But if you're controlling a large chunk of Iraq's parliament, and we are ostensibly in, meaning the United States is ostensibly in Iraq to fight the Islamic State, well, what happens one day when they say, okay, we voted you out? Well, they didn't really need the military power for that, but they did build it and had political influence. So there's a threat on that side, because we've all seen what's happened when the Americans step out of certain areas, and guess what? What else metastasizes? Another crazy Sunni jihadist group, or the Iranians take advantage of yet another thing that's going on and take more power for themselves. So that's one threat. The other threat is the armed threat. That's the one I guess most people consider. So we're talking anywhere from terrorist attacks that could happen abroad, could happen in the Middle East, you know, could happen in Western countries. And there has been a lot of Lebanese Hezbollah and IRGC scouting around the United States and around Western Europe for Western targets. Jewish targets too, Israeli targets, diplomats, you name it. Hell, there was almost, the Saudi ambassador was almost assassinated down the street from us here in DC. So there's a lot of different things that they can really bring to the table. I mean, I think there's another developing issue here too, where, you know, a lot of people in the press get really excited about this. Oh, they're using drones, or they're using some technology that, yeah, it's been around for kind of a while now. Big deal. But the big deal isn't really that. The big deal is how they're using it and how it's changing the face of warfare. So with the drone attacks, I mean, the Houthis, or Ansar al-Law, we call them the Houthis, but Ansar al-Law has launched a number of attacks using drones. Right. Now, in Iraq, you have another issue with drones. Qatalib Hezbollah and also Lebanese Hezbollah in Lebanon have both hacked into American and Israeli drones. The Shayatet 13 issue that happened earlier in the 90s, that was the result of them hacking into an Israeli drone. They had intelligence that was there. They saw it was scouted out, and they were able to essentially defeat a much more superior unit. In Iraq, they were taking footage of President Obama getting off the plane and going on his, in his limo to Iraqi policymakers and senior statesmen. And of course, they had the wink and the nudge on their television station, said, we could have done it, but we didn't want to hurt any local Iraqis. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you have this much more advanced, at times asymmetric tactics, but they're using them in a larger sphere. And kind of from 30,000 feet, they're doing quite a good job at not just incorporating these new systems into kind of how they fight their battles. I mean, because they're using drones on the battlefield, but also armed drones to attack and threaten different neighbors, and now also hacking into stuff and causing other problems for propaganda victories. It doesn't look that bad for them. You know, I don't want to use, again, this is an overused DC expression. I don't want to make them 10 feet tall. They're not 10 feet tall, but they're doing pretty well for their rather small stature.
Yeah. And we've seen, you know, Israel now openly admit to striking a lot of these targets in eastern Syria, western Iraq, opening up a new front, or this front has been opened up. So what else do you think it's going to take to push back against these capabilities for the United States and for Israel to protect against these threats?
So I've heard this line quite a bit in D.C. that Israel strikes in Iraq, you know, had the potential for blowback onto U.S. forces. I frankly, I don't really buy that argument. I just want to get that out of the way first and foremost. I don't really buy the argument because they're going to blame the Israelis or blame the Americans for whatever they want to do later on.
Yeah.
And sometimes they send signals anyway and we don't even pick up on them. So again, just wanted to shift that, but it kind of leads me to my next point. And the next point is there's very little you can do in terms of dealing with the Iranians unless it comes down to kind of a full court press. You know, the United States has something called maximum pressure right now, which is essentially just a lot of sanctions. And sometimes they're just ineffective sanctions, or we don't know how effective or ineffective they actually are. It's kind of guesswork. So it needs to take on more pressure. And I think the Israelis see this because they wouldn't have started hitting in Iraq if they didn't understand that the calculations had to go in a different direction.
Right.
But, you know, I'm kind of one who would say, if you really wanted to get rid of the problem, well, that means you're going to have an actual full-fledged conflagration, a full-fledged war. Again, I'm not arguing for that, but there's very little one can do when, let's say, the Iranians ingratiate themselves so well into local societies. I'm not saying everyone loves these Persian speakers and they love Wilayat al-Faqih, but they understand how to phase it in over time. They're thinking about this in a very, very long term, whereas we think within four-year blocks.
Can you speak a little bit more to this long-term plan from Iran?
Sure. Ayatollah Khomeini, the first supreme leader of Iran and the guy who came up with the absolute Wilayat al-Faqih ideology, was very clear about it in his speeches to students, his speeches to what eventually became the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard Corps, you know, where he would say, well, this isn't, and I'm paraphrasing, this is not a two-year fight. It's going to take a very long time. And remember how, you know, al-Din al-Islam, the Islamic religion, the true religion of the world, we are leaders of that. You guys are that core force that's going out. You are the Hezbollah. You are the party of God that has to go out and reach out and touch someone. But sometimes you need to be strategic and pull back. There's a big line, and I think I repeat this during every single talk I've ever given, maybe since 2012, about Iran. There are a ton of units that are within the Iranian order of battle that are called sabrin, and they love this term sabr. Sabr is patience, and it's a Quranic concept. and the subarine are kind of like the patient ones. And it's interesting to note that a lot of their groups are called that, or when they have to cut back on certain armed attacks or other bad behavior, they'll issue different statements that kind of mention the Quranic sabr. Remember, guys, it's patience. Slowly, don't worry, they'll lose interest. Don't worry, the Americans are a paper tiger, as Khomeini would say. You hit them hard in one place, or maybe you escalate in a few different places, and you watch how they react. Don't worry, they're not in this for the win, whereas we are. I think of the Iranians in terms of, and we're talking, I'm not saying every Iranian. I mean, I hate always having to caveat this, but you kind of have to for most audiences. Most people don't believe in their ideological setup. Even people who are fighting within their military forces and proxies that they have will openly say, we believe in Wilayat al-Faqih. For the most part, they're just like normal dudes who fight and are sometimes functioning, for lack of better terms, in a mercenary function, or it's just a good opportunity for them. But that ideological component is still very important, and the Iranian leadership understands it. I'm talking about Khamenei, Qasem Soleimani with IRGC-QF, and all the other IRGC guys. They understand that, well, yeah, Rome wasn't built in a day, and you have to slowly do this. But, and this is the more important thing, for true believers, it is essentially the Hebrew National Ad. And the Hebrew National Ad going, we answer to a higher power. Well, literally speaking, the ideology comes back to that, where Khamenei, or I should say Khomeini and then Khamenei, believe that the position in Arabic, it's called Wali al-Faqih, or the Wali or Vali in Persian, that they are the representative for Imam al-Mahdi on earth. And because of that, that means that whatever they're doing, it's kind of like being the Pope in many cases. Because you're doing that and in a political function, it's almost like Pope Urban II. I need to lead a crusade somewhere. And I need to get the political function so it fits what I need to do because I'm God's representative. And that's how they tend to think about it. And I think that's very confusing, especially for a lot of Westerners who want to go, yeah, but you know what? When you look at it, there's these economic incentives. No, it doesn't mean that they don't see things like that.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, the ideology still drives it. It's kind of like sanctioning the Iranians in some cases. It's and I hate to do a reductio ad Hitlerum here, but it's a good comparison. You know, the Nazis were getting bombed every single day by B-17s, B-24s. They had the Soviets who were pouring in and raping and destroying everything on the Eastern Front. And Brits and Americans coming in the other section just destroying everything flat out. Did the Nazis kind of just say, well, this maximum pressure is really working. We need to look at this rationally, kind of like how a graduate from Georgetown would look at it. And, you know, this theoretical construct, they don't do that because the ideology was what was really, you know, driving that core force. And I think with them, I mean, they're trying to build a similar model when, you know, they look at how the world works. So, I mean, that's kind of their thing.
Well, Philip, thank you so much for this really in-depth overview. I don't know if you can call it an overview if it's so in-depth, but we're grateful for your time and expertise on this.
Thank you for chatting with me. I always appreciate it.